Welcome to Parents Perspective. Just when we think we've gotten through the thick of child rearing, adolescence strikes. And how can we tell when this is about to happen? There are several unmistakable warning signs. If we have a son, he begins to eat nearly as frequently as he breathes. If we have a daughter, she often gives that up altogether. While she's trying to look like a stick with a head on it, he disappears into the basement and works on lifting heavy objects, not, of course, groceries. Both become so attached to the telephone that it begins to seem like a part of their anatomy. Both have perfected the anatomical feat of rolling their eyes immediately upon the first sign that you might speak. But it's possible you might miss some of these early signals because of the last and most significant clue. When they hit adolescence, they retreat to their rooms and might not be seen for days. But don't fret. Eventually they'll come out to ask for the car keys. I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. We're fortunate today to have as our guest an expert in traversing the teenage minefield. Dr. Wade F. Horn, a psychologist, is president of the National Fatherhood Initiative and an adjunct faculty member at Georgetown University's Public Policy Institute. He is also a member of the U.S. Advisory Board on Welfare Indicators. Dr. Horn has written a new book, Better Homes and Gardens' New Teen Book. He has two daughters at home, ages 15 and 17. We're so glad you could join us today, Dr. Horn.
It's great to be with you again.
What makes adolescence such a distinct period in a child's development?
Well, I think your kids go crazy during the teenage years, and that makes it somewhat distinctive. What makes it so distinctive is the struggle for adolescence is the struggle to achieve an identity separate from the family. Because after all, the goal of childhood in the end is to become an adult and to leave the home, to venture out on their own into the outside world. And that's a pretty scary proposition for most people. And so this is what we call the push and pull of adolescence. The idea that on the one hand, the adolescent understands that their task is to leave the family, go out into the outside world, and become independent of the family, yet at the same time, they're unsure about whether they're able to negotiate this, this new sort of separation. And so what you get is that sort of sometimes the I'm completely independent of you. I don't need you at all. And at the other times, you'll get this sort of dependence, this sort of rush back to the family. And that's what can be so confusing to a lot of parents.
What are an adolescent's biggest concerns, would you say?
Well, one of them is not to be embarrassed. If there's one rule for parents, it is this. Please don't embarrass your teenagers in public. That is like the worst thing that can happen to a teenager is to feel embarrassed.
And sometimes it happens by just showing up, doesn't it?
Oh, well, yes. That can be, they think their hair doesn't look quite right and they're embarrassed to go outside. Or they get a pimple and that's embarrassing. They can't go outside. Or more significantly, they get teased by others at the school, and that can be quite embarrassing. Or the parent says something when their friends are around that can be embarrassing. And teenagers will do just about anything to avoid feeling embarrassed in front of their peers.
I used to be told by a couple of my kids, if they had performances, that I shouldn't show up with that face.
Too much enthusiasm on that face. Don't bring it along.
Needless to say.
You can come, but be quiet.
Right? It wasn't even that. I wasn't allowed to look however I looked. It was very upsetting.
How can parents prepare for this stage that they know their children are going to go through?
Besides putting a paper bag over their head.
Well, I think that the most important thing is for parents to understand that this is a very critical stage for their children's development, that going through the adolescent years is something that is critical if their kids are going to negotiate a successful transition from the family and dependence on the parents to independence. And this is as important a phase as any other in a child's life. It's as important as the terrible twos, for example, as kids first start to assert their autonomy. It's as important as the middle years as they start to expand their world to include peers and school and so forth, yet still being quite dependent upon parents. This is a very important time in a child's life, and for parents to understand that the central task of adolescence is to establish their own identity, an identity which, sure, borrows some, hopefully, from the family and from the parents, but at the same time is distinct, an identity that they can venture out into the external world with and feel comfortable with and confident that they can be independent from the family. And the parents' role is to support their child in accomplishing that task.
What kind of ages are we talking about? We're talking and talking about adolescence. Let's cover the years.
Yeah, I think that most people mistakenly believe that adolescence begins at 13 because the word 13 has teen in it, so that must be when teenagers sort of arrive. Well, if you believe that and you've got an 11-year-old, you're in for a rude awakening. 11, 10 years old even is really the entrance into adolescence, particularly in today's world when there's so much more impinging upon a child from the outside world than that you can't protect them from than might have been the case 30, 40, 50 years ago. And so adolescence seems to be occurring earlier and earlier, as young as 10 and 11. And that's when kids are starting to struggle with these kinds of issues.
How does the role of a father change as his children move into adolescence?
Well, hopefully, fathers understand that there are sort of two important roles for them in the adolescent years. And most fathers do, by the way. It comes kind of natural to them. I think what's important is that they understand how important these two aspects are of successful fathering. One is to monitor their adolescent's behavior. One of the great mistakes that parents make with adolescents is they think that monitoring their child's behavior is sort of a linear relationship. That is, we monitor a lot when they're babies, we lessen that monitoring as they get into the elementary school, and we continue to lessen the monitoring as the child becomes an adolescent. Wrong. That's a way for your kids to get in real trouble. And what we need to do is redouble our efforts to monitor our kids' behavior when they become adolescents. Know where they are. Know who they're hanging out with. Know who their friends are. Know when they're coming back. If they're getting in a car with somebody, know who that person is. We need to be better as parents at monitoring our kids' behaviors. And fathers in particular tend to be sort of specialists in this. You know, they're the ones who say, now, when are you coming back? Who are you going with? And so forth. The second thing that fathers tend to do is they tend to specialize in helping children transition to the outside world. You know, they actually do this when their kids are very young. Fathers are more external world focused. Mothers are more internal family focused. Now, there's always exceptions, of course. There's always exceptions that disprove the stereotype or the rule. But in general, this tends to be the case. For example, if you look at the way that mothers hold babies versus the way that fathers hold babies, mothers tend to hold them close in with their face against their chest. Fathers are more likely to hold their babies on their knees with their face out, facing the world. Because fathers see their task as helping their children negotiate and understand the external world. Well, when does that become a real issue? During adolescence. And so fathers tend to be the ones who bring their kids to the outside world in ways that are different than mothers do. They encourage more risk-taking, for example, in teenagers, even though they monitor them more closely. In some ways, they encourage more risk-taking by giving a little bit more latitude on some of the household rules. Now, that can be a double-edged sword, and fathers need to be careful about that. Fathers need to understand the difference between encouraging healthy, calculated risk-taking and foolish, sort of impulsive risk-taking. But those are the two roles that fathers play in the adolescent world. One is sort of monitoring their behavior and also helping them transition to the external world.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion of adolescence.
The excellent new book, Parents as Mentors, by hosts Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is a practical guide to bringing out the abilities in your child. Parents as Mentors is available at all bookstores.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. Today we are talking about teenagers with Dr. Wade F. Horn.
We wanted to talk a little more about this risk-taking bit that you just brought up. Most adolescents take some form of risks. Automatically, that's what we see in the news all the time. How can parents actually handle this?
Well, if adolescents never took a risk, they'd never leave home. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, that's, you know, the biggest risk of all is leaving this family, leaving this loving family that's nurtured me for 17, 18 years. I mean, my goodness, what bigger risk than leaving the nest? So if adolescents never took risk, they'd never leave home. So risk-taking by itself is not a bad thing. But there are different levels of risk. There's one level of risk for someone who says, you know, I think I'm going to go against the way that my peers are dressing and do something a little different. That's one level of risk. Another level of risk is, I think I'm going to have sex at 13, or I think I'm going to start drinking and driving when I'm 15. Those are different levels of risk. So what you want to do is encourage your child attempts at independence and sort of low-level risk-taking and calculated risk-taking, while at the same time understanding that you need to be there to pull them back in, to pull in the reins when they take too high level of risk. And the only way to do that is to be involved in your kid's life.
We encourage our kids to try new things. That's risk-taking. Try new things. You don't have to be a roller skater. You can be a gymnast. Try new things. See if there's something else that you like. And so you're differentiating is sort of teaching values, it seems.
That's right. Although my teenager sometimes will look at me when I say, well, why don't you try it? She'll say, why should I try something I don't like?
We've all heard
makes
that.
Makes perfectly good sense. Now, what about... You talked about peer groups a little bit. How can parents get involved in an adolescent's peer group relationships without really seeming to take over or to be involved in a non-productive way?
There was a book that was published a year or so ago by Judith Rich Harris called The Nurture Assumption. And in that book, she makes the argument that it's parents don't matter, it's peers that matter. And there's a certain level of truth to that. There's a certain level of truth to the idea that in the teenage world, peers are quite important. But here's the good news for parents. It is not true that parents don't matter. In fact, when you look at the big stuff, the big risks teenagers can take, things like drinking, engaging in early and promiscuous sexual activity, taking drugs, smoking, the big stuff, what new studies have shown is that children are much less likely to get involved in that kind of high-risk behaviors if they have good relationships with their parents, and that parents are much more powerful predictors of whether a kid is going to get involved in those kinds of high-risk behaviors than peers are. Now, it doesn't help if the peer group is a deviant peer group. And so what parents need to do is to monitor their kids, know who their friends are. And if their peer group is a destructive peer group, if it is a peer group that engages in high-risk behaviors, I'll be honest with you and tell you, I think that parents need to step in and separate their child from the peer group. Because what you're not going to get a medal for doing this. You're not mm-hmm. going to, you know, your teenager's not going to say, gee, thanks, Mom and Dad, for, taking me away from this peer group that's drinking and doing drugs and having sex all over the place. They won't say it when you do it, but they may say it a year later. They may say it when they reflect and they see how important it was for them to get out of that destructive peer group. So you got to know who your child's friends are. And if it is, in fact, a destructive peer group, you need to take steps to separate them from that.
How would you do that to parents who are thinking, oh, my God, how am I going to do this?
Well, one of them is to redirect. You know, we talk about young kids, you know, when they're having a temper tantrum or they don't want to do something, we redirect their attention to something else. Well, we can use that same strategy with our teenagers. Redirect them to a different peer group. Get them involved, for example, in a youth group at your church or your synagogue. Get them involved in sort of an after-school activity where you know that there's some close adult supervision. Get them involved in other kinds of positive peer experiences. Volunteering, for example. Have them, you know, do something, you know, with good youth that are out there, you know, with Habitat for Humanity or working at a homeless shelter or a food bank or something like that. Redirect their attention to a positive peer group and then hope that will help to be a magnet that will draw them to that kind of peer experience as opposed to the negative one. Because most kids underneath understand when they're getting into that they're getting into trouble with these deviant peer groups, and it scares them. And it's a message to parents that's saying, help me, pull me back. It's like the little kid who is about to dart into the street. He wants to know his mom or dad is going to pull him back if he darts into the street. If the kid's darting into a deviant peer group, it's parents' job to pull them back. You won't get a medal immediately, but down the road, your kids will thank you for it.
I recently spoke with a mother in upstate New York who's talking with her daughter. The daughter actually got on the phone at one point. The daughter was pulled out of one high school and moved to another high school by the parents. And the daughter understood why. She was absolutely traumatized at leaving behind good friendships. She's a very good student. And her parents said, all you do is talk on the phone. Everyone goes out every night on school night. She and the child and the father were fighting all the time about what the child wanted to do because of the peer group she was in. And they said, you know, it might be easier for you to live up to the way our family does things if you were in a different environment. Interestingly, they moved this, the oldest of three daughters. The second one is still in that other high school because her group of friends was a different group of friends. The older daughter got on the telephone. She heard her mother talking about her, and she said, I agree it was a good decision. I was very angry when it happened. So sometimes we have to take those gambles and do what we think is right.
That's right. And thankfully, for most kids, the peer groups that they find themselves in are pretty decent peer groups. Mm. This is the exception, not the rule, that kids are drawn into really horrible, destructive peer groups. When it does happen, parents need to take aggressive steps, certainly, to correct that. But I also think, parents need to give their kids a little slack, too. I mean, if this is a reasonably decent peer group and they listen to some music that you and I might not want to, I think that's okay. Now, there's limits even on that. For example, I've got a 15 and 17-year-old, and they know they simply are not allowed to have in our house CDs with parental advisories on them. Because it takes a lot to get a parental advisory on a CD. I mean, this is, not just sort of soft stuff. This is bad stuff. And they just know it. And occasionally, they try to sneak one in the house, and I find it. And we say, we've talked about this. We confiscate it. They say, okay, they're sorry. You have to be aware of what's happening with your kids. You have to be engaged in their lives, particularly with teenagers. Too many parents think teenage years, I'll sort of like step back and say, okay, I've tried to do the best. You make your choices from now on. No, that happens when your kid leaves the home. That doesn't happen when your kid's 15. If your kid could make all the choices for themselves at 15, they wouldn't need you. They'd be on their own. They'd have their own place. They'd have their own money. That's what happens when they become adults. But so long as they're living in your home, parents should not be afraid. In fact, they are doing a disservice to their teenagers if they are not monitoring their kids' behaviors and setting effective limits while, of course, demonstrating how much they love and care for them as well.
I was just going to ask you if you could sort of define for our listeners, what is a good relationship between children and parents? How can we outline that?
Well, I'll tell you one thing it's not. It's not being a friend. You know, friends are different than parents. You know, there's other times, when your kids become adults, you can plenty of time to become friends with them then. But, when your kids are still living with you, they are counting on you to be their parents. And what that means is you show a great deal of love and affection for your kids. That's very important. Tell your kids you love them every single day. Give them hugs. Even if, they go, oh, mom, or oh, dad, when you give them a hug. There's always a smile, a little bit of a smile on their face when they say that. Now, don't do it in front of their friends. That'll embarrass them. But do it, in the home where it's a little bit private. Give them a hug. Tell them how much you love them. That's very important. At the same time, you need to set effective limits and be willing to enforce those limits. Set household rules. Make them understand that those rules are things that you will, in fact, enforce. Now, obviously, as kids get older, the household rules relax some, but not completely. Again, you can, when their kids leave the home, you can completely do away with household rules. They can set their own. But while they're living with you, there ought to be household rules, and you ought to be willing to enforce them. And then finally, a good parent ought to monitor their kids' behavior. And what study after study shows is that when kids have this kind of good relationship with their parents, they have parents they feel that they can go talk to, they have parents who they can count on to pull them back when they're getting into trouble. These are the kids that really avoid those high-risk behaviors that we're all so fearful about. I mean, when you ask a parent of an 8- or 9-year-old, what do you think about the teenage years? They go, my goodness, I just hope they don't get into drugs, they don't start having sex too early, they don't, you know, start smoking cigarettes, all that bad stuff. They're so afraid of that. And I say, concentrate not on, you know, necessarily, oh, that can't hurt, bringing your kids to anti-smoking, you know, seminars. Concentrate instead on your relationship with your child. If you have a good relationship with them, that will be the most important protective factor against those high-risk behaviors.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion of adolescence.
For an audio cassette copy of Any Parent's Perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. Today we are talking about teenagers with Dr. Wade F. Horn. What kind of guidelines would you suggest for things like driving, partying, drinking, the kinds of things that parents do have a lot of concern for?
Well, the most important guideline is understanding that your kids don't get these privileges simply by virtue of age. What they do is they earn those privileges. And so if they start to negotiate, gee, I want to stay out a little bit later, or I want to be able to drive, or whatever, that is negotiated in the context of their overall behavior. Are they, you know, doing well at school? Is their behavior at home acceptable? Is their behavior outside of the home acceptable, and so forth? And that what you communicate to your child is that these are privileges that you earn, not rights that you get simply by virtue of the fact that you've now passed some birthday milestone. And that's a very important one in terms of driving. You know, in some states you can get a driver's license as young as 15 and a half or 16. Well, you know, kids at 15 and a half and 16 don't have the judgment of a 28-year-old or a 35-year-old. And yet they believe that because the law says you can drive at 15 and a half or 16, by gum, I can drive at 15 or 16. Well, I think parents need to say, no, what the law says is that's legally permissible if I give you permission to do it, and that what you need to do is demonstrate through the rest of your behavior that you're responsible enough to take on this. And then to monitor them, so if they show signs, after you give them that privilege of abusing it, you take the privilege away. That's what good parents do about these mm-hmm. these kinds of situations.
You give some guidelines in the new teen book.
Yes. Actually, what we do in the new teen book is we divide the book into two halves. And the first half is sort of the narrative. It tells you the sort of themes about parenting teenagers. And in the back, it's an A to Z guide. So if you're having a particular issue about dating or about self-esteem or about eating problems, you know, these are all sort of cataloged in the back of the book. You can just look it up, look up the problem or the issue that you're interested in.
Terrific. Very user-friendly.
We tried to make it user-friendly.
What about schoolwork during adolescence? This is a time, obviously, when the grades count toward college and things get a lot more serious and heavy duty. How involved do you feel parents should be, and in what way?
Well, you know, there are two mistakes parents can make about grades. One is to put too much emphasis on them, and the other is to put too little. That is to either pressure your kids and say, unless you got all A's and you go to Harvard, you're going to have a horrible, miserable life. None of that is true. On the other hand, if you say, gee, your grades are completely up to you and you're flunking out and, boy, that's your choice, you know, I mean, that's not being a good parent either. What you need to do is to help your kids understand the seriousness of the schoolwork, encourage them to do it. Don't do it for them, but encourage them to do it. And talk to them when, they, in fact, they're having difficulties at school. I've got a daughter right now who's having some difficulty in pre-calculus.
That sounds understandable.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, and you know what? That has now, you know, exceeded my limit of knowledge in the area. And so we got her a tutor outside of school. And that's a way a parent can be helpful, is finding solutions to difficulties. She wants to do better in pre-calc. The tutor is a possibility. I can't help her in pre-calc. this seems to be a reasonable solution. But on the other hand, you don't want to say, gee, pre-calculus, you're never going to need it, which is what my daughter tells me. When am I going to need pre-calculus? And I say, well, you need to get a, you know, you need to pass this course anyway, and that's what's going to help you by getting a tutor, as opposed to saying, well, you're right, so you don't have to worry about it.
What about rewards for good grades?
Well, you know, my question is, what happens when they go to college? You know, when you're, I mean, how many cars can you give them for getting straight A's? I don't like the idea of big rewards for grades. I like the better idea of a more consistent pattern of involvement in the child's education and positive verbal reinforcement and praise for effort, not necessarily just for grades.
Okay, well, you have made a tremendous effort here for us. We really appreciate all of your wisdom and your insights. All of our listeners are going to have a whole lot more to work with when their children become teenagers. Thank you to Dr. Horn for being with us today. Our gift for today's lucky caller is an autographed copy of Dr. Horn's wonderful new book, Better Homes and Gardens, New Teen Book. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573. That's 1-800-791-8573. We're looking forward to hearing from you, and we'd like to send you Better Homes and Gardens' new teen book.
You can also reach Parents Perspective through your local station or by email to parentsper, that's P-A-R-E-N-T-S-P-E-R, at AOL.com. Or again, call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573. To learn more about us and our book, Parents as Mentors, visit our website through our shortcut address, http://i.am/parentsperspective, all one word. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.